Father's Day is coming up, and I wanted to offer something useful to dads who are tired of living a divided life. So I'm hosting a live workshop called Become a Better Leader by Becoming a Better Dad. Here's the core idea. We are not two different men, not a work self and a home self. We are one engine. And when there's a crack in how we lead at home, impatience, disconnection, reactivity, it shows up at work too, just in a different form. Because the real issue isn't our behavior. It's the patterns we fall back on when we don't have anything left. I call that version of us default dad. He's the one who shows up when we're tired, overloaded, or distracted. And while that pattern is easiest to spot at home, it affects our leadership everywhere. This workshop is a practical playbook to help you catch default dad earlier, lead with more intention under pressure, and become a calmer father and stronger leader. It's free. Consider it my Father's Day gift to dads. The link to register is in the show notes below, or visit ambitiousdads.com. Welcome to another edition of the Ambitious Dads podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Hittner. You know, after more than 200 interviews with fathers, I realized we're just not talking enough. Not about our fears, nor our ambitions, nor how our kids are really doing, or how we're holding up in the middle of all of it. This podcast is for the dads trying to build something meaningful and be present at home. The ones caring a lot, questioning if they're doing enough, and craving honest conversations without the filters. If that's you, you're not alone. You are in the right place. Let's figure this out together. And today we have a very special guest. We have Bob Glazier, and Bob is the founder and chairman of the board of Acceleration Partners, which is a global leader in partnership marketing. He is, of course, also a serial entrepreneur and award-winning executive, and he's truly passionate about helping individuals and organizations elevate their performance. He actually shares his great insights through a weekly newsletter called Friday Forward, which reaches over 200,000 readers in more than 100 countries. And he also is the author of 7 books, including the newly launched The Compass Within. Bob, it's an absolute pleasure to have you join me today and looking forward to our conversation.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
You bet. Now, of course, I left out the most important part, which is you're a father of 3. Can you tell me a little bit about your family makeup at the moment?
I admit to 2 of them, but I'll let them figure out which 2. Sure. I have my wife and I met when we were younger. So we got going on our kids in marriage in our lower 20s. So I have a senior in college, a sophomore in college, and a junior in high school. So I'm coming to that twilight window of kids at home.
That's pretty awesome. And tell me off the top of your head, where are you kind of, where's the majority of your, like if you have sleepless nights or worry when it comes to your children, where is it circling around these days?
I don't know. My wife and I probably have opposite, sleepless things on this. I'm worried, and not really worried, but that, you know, talking to peers and stuff, the kids who have grown up in, you know, semi-affluent neighborhoods or under not struggle, I'm worried that they're not adjusted for the realities of the world and AI and all this stuff. So I think there's some things that just kind of in our life that are as normal. So I if anything, like my kids are good kids. I'm worried that, you know, they not that they even like have too much, but like that you know, they don't have the dog fighting skills that might be needed in the world today, particularly as a lot of them. One of the things that I've come to appreciate is that I think like even some of the things that we tell our kids consistently that I think go against some of the suburban community culture, I realize they're, you know, running up into that because of what their friends are doing and what peers are doing and what they're hearing from teachers and you got to go do this. And I try to talk my kids a lot off of that. I mean, one of the things, like, you know, every kid in college now, you know, at certain schools is, it's just, they think the only jobs are banking and consulting because that's all anyone talks about and that's all anyone wants to do. And trying to sort of unprogram that has been interesting. Well, don't I want to get one of those jobs? Don't I want, like, well, do you like that? Like, does it interest you? Like, I actually feel like I'm on the opposite of a lot of parents on this conversation.
You know, so I hear a couple of different threads here. So one is on the side of, like, when they are lucky enough, blessed enough to be raised in a situation where they don't really have a lot of needs or
they have first world struggles, right? And look, I think that's real to every kid and their lived experience and whether you've had friend issues or bullying or whatever and all this stuff. But there's just a little bit different than, like, I've got to work to help my single mom put food on the table or something like that, that you just have perspective. I mean, I've been in multiple groups where people are like, I'm taking my kids to India or something like that because they're like, and they realize it's their fault, but, like, they just don't have the perspective. And I think, to me, it's always the parents' fault. One of my favorite speakers, a leadership guy, is Eric Kaptulik, and he trained people in the military. And he said, people always say to me, kids these days, he's like, I don't want to hear that. And he tells a story about this 18-year-old kid who took a bullet in his Jeep to drive all the other people down. He's like, it's parents these days. Kids are not the ones who have made themselves unaccountable and not followed through and done all this stuff. So yeah, I think a lot of the things are manifestations of parenting and cultural.
So how do you solve for that in your family? So if it's like a direct example where they just have, you know, every new tech tool under the sun, or it's something else related to just entitlement, how do you manage that?
My kids all work and they have to. They all got jobs at 16 and they need to work and they need to pay for their own stuff. And I don't feel bad if that interferes with school or otherwise. Like, I worked and I didn't necessarily have to, but I think a work ethic is something new. In fact, we're one of the few parents who, like don't really give the kids, like, at the college, like, they're responsible for paying for their stuff and they work over the summer. You know, it's our privilege to pay for the education. But I don't pay to drink for drinking, and Chick-fil-A and, you know, all those things. and we just got into an argument with our youngest last night because I just, you know, there's stuff that they're, you know, can get and they have a card and, but there's stuff that they're supposed to do. And he didn't come home for dinner on a weeknight and went out. And I was like, you better not have put that on our card. And he did. And I was like, we don't do that. Like, dinner is on the table at our house, you know, 5 nights a week or something. And if you want to opt out of that and do something with a friend, like, that's on you. But, like, we're not covering that. So I think there's some red lines like that, or else it just becomes normalized that, you know, DoorDash and $18 takeout are kind of a regular, you know, thing these days.
I really appreciate hearing this. And for all the dads who are nodding their head yes, but still aren't quite sure how they make that happen culturally in their family, what has made it work for you all?
Look, I talk to a lot of parents who are super frustrated. And I remember talking to someone, you know, it was like, look, my kids are like it's their fault. Like I said, like they were super frustrated that their kids were not being responsible with spending in college. And they would send them pictures of them drinking and then they would get a thing on their Amex thing popped up of them at the bar and they'd be like, why am I paying for this? I'm like, have you set any rules or expectations? And they're like, no, they're generally good. I'm like, well, so you have no, like, any organization, you need red lines, right? And you need clear. So I was like, well, I've heard a bunch of different ways. I've heard people saying, here's $300 a month or $200 a month and you can do for it. Here's your own credit card. I've heard people saying, I budgeted out the year. Actually, here's $1,000 at the beginning of the year. And this should cover the food and books. And, you know, you can figure it out. And again, you charge it on your cards. In fact, I just had a funny, we'll call it argument/discussion with my wife last night. I'm like, because generally our kids are good about this stuff. And again, they have our card because sometimes they have to Uber from school and coming home for Thanksgiving. And, like, that stuff that we pay for. But there's been some gray area and they're a little slow on the reimbursement, right? They use our card. I'm like, this is why companies flip the policy. They take away the corporate card and they say you can charge it on your... So I've changed the rule. I'm like, you know what? You make a request and we Venmo you back rather than finding the thing on the card that you weren't supposed to charge. So I think you need rules, and I think it's really good for kids and to be explicit. And a lot of the parents I know are frustrated by it, but they don't do anything or they don't have any norm. And you're trying to teach the kids discipline. I mean, I remember I had a friend in college, his dad gave him twice the amount of money that any of us got per month. And we were older. So this was kind of our living and spending when you didn't have the meal plan. But his dad made him like keep QuickBooks, run a P&L and send the P&L at the end of every month, you know, before he sent the next money, and he had to budget and manage it all. And as an adult, he is incredibly responsible and a good caretaker and a good fiduciary. So sometimes it's not even the money. It's just, I think there's tons of kids in college these days that have this notion of you put things on a credit card and you never see it again. And we've encouraged our kids to get the credit and get the cards and build credit and put it on themselves. Again, we're not perfect. Things fall through the crack, but you got to have a system and you got to explain the why. And so last night I was like, look, next time I see this, like, I take the card back and you don't have it at all. And you're going to have to come ask us to reimburse you for everything, you know, that we spend it through. To me, that's the same thing you do in a company in leadership. You broke the, we had a general understanding about this. That was outside of that. And if you do it again, here's the consequence.
I love it. My kids are obviously younger. So right now we are at the stage where if they get a little money, they have to put it into one of three buckets. It's grow, or what is it? It's give, save, and spend.
Tax.
So that they learn their sort of different buckets for the money that comes in. But I love the sophistication at which you've got it at this point with your family. The other thing you talked about in that sort of initial thread at the beginning was this idea of jobs afterwards and consulting or banking. And to me, it sounded like that thread was a little bit about like... really making sure that the definition of success that your kids have is more closely aligned with like your values and what you're trying to bring up in your whole family. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because a lot of the dads that I speak with are really challenged about like creating their own definition of success for their families, but also how to speak it to their families.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the biggest, you know, mistakes or thing that people end up either in therapy or unhappy, you know, at some point in their life. And that's, we take our definition of success. You know, if you have your kids in sports, you know, particularly around soccer or hockey, you see a lot of mediocre parents, you know, have their kids playing these sports, you know, five nights a week, and they're going to burn out because it's about what they wish they had the ability to do. And so I think there's values and talents. Like my job as a parent is to transmit my most important values to my kids. You know, my wife has her values, and then we have the kind of family values. And then also like everyone's good at different things, and everyone, I don't necessarily believe in the find your passion. I think that's tricky advice, right? And as someone, I heard someone say that's said by rich people who have already made a lot of money. But figure out what you like and what you can be good at and what you can become kind of an expert at vocationally. And from that, I think the money will follow.
You know, so you were saying, I guess my question is, they still have all this exposure and at school, right? Around, you know, Maria is about to take this job. Joey's about to take this job at this bank, at this consulting firm.
And it starts sophomore year. So this is even my daughter, you know, the pressure with all these kids coming back from their junior, they interview sophomore year for their junior year jobs. They come back from junior year jobs with an offer. And that feels like, I was like, you're right where you're supposed to be fall of senior year. You're not supposed to have a job until like April or May of, we've gotten these kids so focused on what's next. You get into any of these schools, you get into a top 50 school these days, and like, it's just the beginning of things that you're going to apply to over the next couple of years. Every club, every abroad, everything is like a whole nother, like, and they're just really focused on what's next. And again, I think that success is like, what is success isn't money being miserable and divorced. I just think, I always say, look, if you're the top frog expert in the world, like if you have a passion of frogs and you're the guy or the woman that people want at frog conventions and you write frog books, like you'll make a living off that. And so I don't think it's to find your passion. I think it's what do you, because your passion can be, some people have a passion for operations and solving problems. And there's so many ways to actualize that. So what do you like what do you want to do? What do you see yourself like? What are the problems that are exciting for you to solve? And then how do you become really good at that? And I think if you become really good at something, A, there's meaning tied to it and financial stability will follow.
Right. But your kids aren't, you know, they're not just hearing this once they get to college, right? It's being sort of inundated and stamped on their heads about this external definition of success all the time. So what are you doing explicitly in your family beyond when, you know, your daughter calls and says, hey, all my friends are already nailing down their jobs a year in advance of graduating? Like, what were you doing in the earlier years to get them to really think more holistically about who they wanted to become?
Yeah. So I think we try to expose, I've incorporated a whole bunch of best practices from different people. I think we try to expose them a lot of things. I like the rule, the sort of Angela Duckworth rule. If you start it, you finish the season, right? You try clarinet, you hate it. Like, you got to try stuff. There's a curve of where when you first do it, it's not great. So you got to learn to push yourself through and then you see if you like it. But if you don't like it, then you shouldn't do it, right? And we got a discussion with my son who was playing a ton of soccer and he was arguing about going to the practice for club. I'm like, look, we're paying a lot of money on this. Like, if we're fighting about the practices, we're not doing this anymore, right? Either you want to do it and you're excited to go to it. I don't need you to do it. I don't want to do it. But everyone who wanted to make varsity, you know, was on a club team. But you either love going to practice or you don't. And I think a lot of people to be good at something like the practice. So I like the try things, exposure to things. If it sucks, you finish it and you don't do it again. So I don't think you should quit something on the first day. And I don't think you should stick with something you don't like. I think there's a sweet spot. And I think a lot of people miss that. You either, it's okay to quit anything or you got to perpetually stick with anything. Like, yeah, you got to get through the first thing to know a bad day or know if you like it. But then I don't force my kids to stay in the stuff that they don't enjoy. I don't think that's the way you learn. And I definitely did not learn that way. In fact, I started getting straight A's for the first time in my life once I got through all the core curriculum and I figured out what I loved, which was business and marketing. And I loved that. And I would study hard for it because I wanted to learn more.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, you are very successful by all external definitions of the word, as we were just talking about. Yeah. What are a few areas that you think you've gotten wrong in terms of balancing like your career ambitions and your home ambitions?
Yeah, again, I think you need bright lines on this stuff. And I was talking to my kids around it, and I was seeing recently to my daughter that I missed her, you know, fifth grade graduation or whatever it was. Now, like the client I ended up going to the thing for became the mainstay client to our business. It was probably resulted in a ton of eventual financial security for my business. And it was probably the right decision. She doesn't remember that at all, right? She doesn't even remember the event. But I joke, like, had I died, like, you know, 6 months later, you might have remembered that, right? So these things are all, but we've had 150 events and graduations in seventh grade. I mean, this is a little bit in the middle. Like I set some lines around this. I traveled a lot. You know, when I was home, I was here for dinner. I don't tend to leave a lot on weeknights, you know, from when I'm home. And I never missed a birthday from when any of them were home. Those were sort of kind of the bright lines that I wanted to do. But look, I think everything comes in season. I believe in work-life integration. I don't believe in balance. Balance is like, I'm on my computer here with you with a dog puppy on my lap who's now locked in the crate downstairs and trying to like be with the puppy. That's balance and that doesn't work. I think you're going to have family week. So I think if you can make them fit together and be where you can be, I've tried to give up the guilt of, you know, oh, I'm gone three nights this week. Well, what do I do with the other three nights? Like, do we go out? Do we do something? Is it more memorable? There was a story I heard years ago where this guy was closing a deal and he was working like crazy, you know, for 2 weeks. And so he'd come home every night at 10 o'clock. And then finally the deal closed. He was like, bud, like, I'm going to be home more or whatever. And the kid looked disappointed, basically, when he was like, the deal. And because of the, he was only home for that half hour every night, like he had done something with the kid or gave a ton of attention or whatever. Sometimes we're trying to get credit for being in the same space, even though they're on TikTok and we're off, you know, doing something else. So I try to focus on the quality. And, you know, I'm having a debate with myself, even like I have a whole bunch of opportunities and stuff next year. It's my son's last, you know, year at home. And I'm just like, I can do whatever I want after that. Like, I think I need to like turn it down, you know, for next, it's my last year's last kid at home. And so I'm consciously thinking about that in my planning, even though it will mean giving up certain things.
Do you bring, especially as your son's getting older, do you bring him into some of that thinking and planning of yours, or is it done kind of without his aware?
Probably it's a little different for each kid. I mean, half the time I plan to be home, go out to dinner, and then he's like, I want to go out with these people instead. So I think it's particularly when you have teenagers and they're boys too, you have to like, what would I have done? What would I have said? You know, I'm watching a show last night and the mother's grounding the kid for showing up to something, a meeting about her father that they couldn't find with the detective. She's like, you would have done the same exact thing. I know you. I know what you were as a kid. So like these things are tricky. I think you don't want to be a hypocrite, but you have to remember how you were. But you also have to, you know, there's some basic things around sort of safety. I think the biggest, I've done a lot of research on this, and I think the biggest mistake today in parenting is that, you know, we are biologically wired to protect our kids, right? And historically, that was physical. You know, there were things like make it through the day and enough food and physical danger. And if you go back to the Spartan warriors, and they would basically beat them to death so that they could survive, you know, in the world. Most of the physical dangers have evaded. And so a lot of what we're doing now is to try to prevent our kids from emotional dangers. And I actually think that that has a huge negative impact, because it's like an immunity system. The way you don't build physicals, you build physical safety. Yes, you can get physically stronger, but you build physical safety by staying out of harm's way, right? Like staying off the bridge you're going to fall off of, or, you know, out of a neighborhood where there's violence or something like that. Emotional, you need exposure to develop the coping mechanism. It is kind of like if you put a kid in a bubble, you know, from when they were young and they develop no antibodies, and then they go in the real world, they would die of viruses in a minute. And that I think is the biggest overcompensation in parenting today. We're not giving our kids freedom to fail. We're not letting them struggle. Again, watching your kid in a suburban first world environment struggle, like that's not even real struggle. You have to, yeah, there are friend group problems. There are all kinds of stuff. And if you keep interfering with it, if you keep solving, they just won't develop these capabilities.
The pressure's on the parents too, right? I mean, because there's constant comparison in the parent conversations as well about what your kid is struggling with versus succeeding at. And then being able to be like, I'm letting him or her kind of find their way through this does not tend to be the common response when there's a bit. Yeah.
I'm working on a book on sort of trying to compare leadership to parenting and why some things that we understand in leadership are absolute best and worst practices. We lose that distinction in parenting. And so it starts off with an anecdote, and the anecdote is, you know, I'm doing Jeff's 360 review, and I look down, it says, you know, and says, Jeff employees say that he tracks them all the time and their whereabouts. He solves their problem for them. He doesn't give them any independent, all of this stuff, to the point if you're reading this, you would be like, we need to fire Jeff, or Jeff needs a thing. And then I flip it to, if you interviewed a bunch of 10-year-olds today, they would say, my parents track me on the thing all the time. They call my teachers and they call my coaches and they do all this. Even the act of tracking your kids and letting them know that you're tracking them all the time, like, it has documented negative consequences, but it's become a default thing. And when you read that side of it, you're like, oh, like, I could totally see any kid saying that. And yeah, why is that like not okay?
Yes, that is a very good point. You know, kind of continuing on this thread, also of values and authentic leadership, which I know you write a lot about, where do you find it harder, or where do you run into more values issues? Do you actually run into it more at home or at work in terms of like really living out these values that you've sort of espoused explicitly? Because often I notice that that there's more trip ups, there's more opportunity to kind of get lost in the exception of the moment with family than I actually see at work. So for me, often it's like living them out at home is more difficult. I'm curious, what about?
I agree. I think the thing is, again, there is this feeling bad, as you said. If you're an employee who violated a rule and you held the consequence, I don't think you'd feel bad. You'd be like, it's crystal clear. But your kid violates a rule and you have a consequence, but that consequence is going to make them miss the party and it's going to cause them emotional harm and whatever. Like you're much more invested in the downstream actions from that. But I think that's where it gets messy, right? I think the most important thing is to be consistent. A lot of parents, you know, they don't have any rule or bright line or say, here's the line. And then something happens and then they have a draconian, you know, response that they're never going to enforce. I'm taking away your phone for a month, or I'm not going to Disney World with it, or something that's like just too far away. Versus I really think like communicating that in advance, like you can do whatever you want. And this is kind of what my parents did. But like my dad, I was like fighting about the curfew. He's like, you can miss the curfew, but you're just not driving for a week if you do. Like, and then you gotta back that up, and it sucks. And yeah, they're going to be sitting home by themselves and they're going to be miserable, whatever. But I don't know how else you don't respect lines. And if you look at what's happened the last couple of years and the entitled class of kids showing up on colleges and breaking rules and taking over buildings, and irrespective of the cause that they're, I'm looking at that. Things that are prohibited very clearly by the school. You can't take over buildings and block people going from class, and it's an existing rule. And then when they are suspended for it, they are absolutely indignant. Like, how could you actually enforce the rule that's on the books when I did this? Because I had my own reason and I had my own justification. And that is a direct impact of all these parents and educators and other leaders in these kids' lives, teaching them that the there isn't cause and effect, like that we'll interfere, we'll get you out of it. You know what? You do drugs and you get caught and we'll call the lawyer and we'll get you out of it. Like I had a parent recently who told me that, you know, they were dealing with some drug stuff with kids and they were like, I wish they had gotten caught by the cop. I wish they scared the crap out of them and spent a night in jail, because that was, you know, and this person I think is a very good parent. And, you know, they were like, it's not my job to make the problem all go away.
It's funny. I fall into this trap often, or I did, where, like, you know, the kids, my boys would be fighting back and forth so much. So I would throw out a punishment that it was like, yeah, too draconian. So I couldn't possibly hold the line. One kid would ignore it. The other would be crying because he thought like he was really not allowed to watch TV for the next 3 months. Yeah. And I suddenly realized the best solution for me and our family was to tell them that they had to come up with the punishment.
Right.
And oh my goodness, did that like flip the whole thing on its head? And, you know, one would actually, neither would ever have one that was like really small. And in fact, their punishment was often too big, but it gave me the space,
right,
to walk it back a little. Yeah.
But they should really know what the red lines are. And ideally, those red lines are values oriented. They're not everything. Right. And I think if you wanted to say, look, we're going to Disney World, and if you do this over and over again, you're not coming. Like, and I'm dead serious about it. I just think you have to be clear, you know, in advance, particularly with the impulse. But the, honestly, the biggest challenge and the thing that, and even we have this discussion in our own family, the thing today that I think the technology, you know, in parenting, I don't know how old your kids are, but I, what I, look, the data on some of this technology is that it's the most dangerous thing they're doing. In fact, they need to be drinking more and more sex. And like, ironically, the loneliness is more dangerous than some of the socialization activities that typically kids and teenagers were worried about. But I see, like, if a kid was drinking in their room and drunk and lonely and depressed, you would go in there and you would rip the alcohol out of their hands. You would rip the cigarettes. You would rip the drugs. But with the tech, people, again, they have this guilt feeling. Oh, well, I'm taking away. This thing is just as harmful. Or everyone would tell you that TikTok is like the most harmful thing on your kids. But people, but parents feel bad about that one. They just don't feel bad about any of the other ones. And I think this is like the great challenge and irony of parenting today, which is no one, if a kid was, you know, miserable and lonely and smoking pot in their room, you would go in there and you would rip all the stuff away and throw it out. And I don't see people looking at technology in that same way, but I think its impact is equivalent, if not worse.
I think one of the things that I've heard from dads that I've interviewed is they feel like a hypocrite because they also aren't ripping the technology away from their own hands.
That is true.
Right?
Yeah.
And to tell their kids no TikTok or, and they're on their own, you know, Instagram, vicious cycle that lasts 30 minutes. I mean, no one needs to poop for 45 minutes anymore, but yet
right.
Here we are. So
it's a possible good. That is, Jeff, that is true. And that is a huge problem. And kids, you know, like leaders, they will react to do it as I do, not as I say. So if you're doing that and you're showing the same behaviors, then you have no credibility. I kind of like the one of the things we've even told her is they set the screen time, you know, and it goes off, but they get to control it. And it's like, so what's the right amount? Like, it's like a budget. Like, we all agree that an hour and a half a day is more than enough. And so, like, that's the budget. And you get to use it how you want it and give them some responsibility. But then they start to see, oh, you know what? I was sitting in the bathroom for 30 minutes and I used up half my time and I don't want to do this. And look, this is, kids can't be, there's ADD and their societal ADD, and kids really can't be quiet anymore. The notion of eating a bowl of cereal without anything or waiting in line or being in a car. Even my daughter in college, like she always calls us when she's driving or when she's walking back from class, and I'm torn. I love hearing from her, but also I'm like, do you realize you're just filling any space, right? You're filling that walk or that drive with calling someone, which is not, again, a social activity. So as I say, I'm telling you in real time, I'm very torn on this, but I also kind of want to highlight sometimes to her that like, just walk to class or drive in the car. You don't need to do any other activity.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting one for sure, because I would probably be more than proud to take a phone call from my kids in school, but also recognizing that like our creativity and our, you know, the reason that so many kids these days are lost on this concept of purpose is because they spend no time thinking about like who they want to be in the world, because as you said, they're filling all those empty spaces with TikTok and with conversation. Tell me, like, one area of fatherhood where vulnerability has felt most uncomfortable for you? And like, what happened when you chose to lean into it? Because a lot of dads, this is an area that we're really starting to have deeper and more meaningful conversations about.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit, look, I'm telling you not to do this, or because it was bad for me, or I had a problem with it, or, you know, this was my learning from it. Like, I think being willing to sort of share that exposure. So for example, right, I heard a conversation recently where a parent was trying to kind of coach a kid on like, you're being a little too eager in follow up, you know, and you're meeting someone and then you're inviting them every day. And you're kind of being a, you know, you're not, the social cues aren't great. Right. So there's a difference between telling that and which you're going to get an eye roll and maybe saying like, look, like I had a really difficult time with this. I remember being 16 and I had a lot of energy. And I remember like I invited this person 3 days in a row to do something and then they never talked to me again. And so that's just like my experience in this, kind of the YPOEO framework. My experience in this would tell you like, I had this pain before, so I'm trying to warn you from having this problem. I think the parents that I know, I think are good parents are really always willing to give the personal example or, you know, don't do drugs from someone you don't know. 'Cause I did that once and it was the worst night of my life. So rather than pretending that they're perfect, you know, and never happened, they're kind of willing to, you know, share those stories. And a couple of times I've really done that with my kids, I think they've been surprised or, you know, and sort of like, oh, really? Like that happened to you? Or you, 'cause they just see you as their kind of infallible parent.
Well, speaking of which, what are some other ways you show your imperfection to your kids? And I'll give you an example. So, you know, when my kids were, particularly my oldest, after he was born, I mean, he would have the worst temper tantrums. And I was just, I couldn't last past 30 seconds. Maybe I would grow to a minute, but these were like lasting 10, 15 minutes. So,
yeah.
You know, eventually I started doing the work on my own triggers. But to make a long story short, with both of my kids, I let them know like that I am always trying to get better at being patient and like not raise my voice. And I encourage them to actually like tell me, like, although that backfires plenty. So when they do something wrong and I raise my voice as it's appropriate, they remind me that I'm supposed to be working on like my patience and not raising my voice. But the point is they see that there are things that daddy is trying to work on and get better at. And I wonder if there are any ways in which you've sort of shared that imperfection with your kids.
I'm always trying to get better at stuff. I mean, they see me with the journal and the goal setting and the failure. And, you know, I just wrote a Friday Ford about how I failed to get the goal of the book last week. So I think just kind of putting that out there. Also, as your kids get older, it's funny. So I have ADD and so I'm not good at switching, and they know this. And my wife knows, like, if you come in the room and I'm on a computer and you're trying to talk to me, like, I kind of like, it's a high cost of switching. So I'll sort of tune it out, right? Or I'll go like, nope, busy. Like, don't bother me now. 'Cause if I get out of this and then I got to go back. So one of my kids in particular really knows this. And so they kind of know that, like, you have to have my attention to have my attention. And they'll be like, can you look at me? I'm about to tell you like what I'm doing for the day. And I want to make sure you're listening. And so again, they learn. I'm like, yep. I'm like, you're very good at that. Like, I'm not yelling at him. Like, he's right. He's very in tune to, like, he knows when he has my, you know, attention or not. And this is the same thing I would say to a kid. Like, yes, do I have to be better at that? Yes. But it's also like kind of just a thing of mine. And so we all have to be aware of it, right? They're not going to change everything about me. I'm not going to change everything about them. But my son last night, who's a little ADD, has to remember to do something. And I was like, look, I like to keep repeating this thing. This is the next Friday Four that I heard someone say. There's two times, you know, now and not now. And I was like, you're saying later. He got a new phone and he has to return the old one in 30 days. And he is not good about this stuff. I'm like, look, you can either go do it now and put it out so you don't forget it, which is a good skill set, you know, or you can maybe remember later and I'm not paying the $200, you know? So, you know, in that way, I'm like, just trying to coach him to like, look, these are systems. You fall to the level of your system. And if you're just going to count on yourself to remember later, I think that's a really bad idea.
Love it. You know, I'm curious, you mentioned like journaling and some of this sort of personal development work you do. How do you share that with your family in it, like in terms of the hopes of maybe them doing some of that? Or is it an active conversation or is it just osmosis or how does it work?
Yeah, I think the more you preach, the less kids do. And so my daughter, I'm joining her this weekend. You know, she just set a goal. She's not a runner, and she set a goal to run her first 10K. And so when she told me she was doing that and we had a conflict on Parents Weekend at school, like, great, I'll come down to watch and we'll run it with you. So we're both going down there. So she always sees that I'm doing that. This was like a stretch goal that she set. You know, the other kids see that she's doing it and we're going down to support her. So I think it's just, they see my... We do vision boards together as a family at the beginning of every year from a goal setting. They see my like one page vision goal document that sits next to my computer every day with stuff they probably shouldn't see on it. I'm sure they snoop through it, but you know, they're seeing like, hey, I'm being pretty intentional, you know, about this stuff.
Hmm. That's very cool. So what do they do with their vision boards when they create them with you? They just have them in their
they go up in their rooms. And then we tend to look back at the end of the year. And there's been, you know, for me, it's a way to make goal setting fun for kids. Like it turns all the goals into sort of pictures or physical things. The challenge, by the way, we've been doing this for over 10 years. The real challenge now is like, there's no magazines anymore. Like we used to collect all the magazines and go to the stores and do this. And there's really like no magazines. So we're pretty good at grabbing them whenever we find them at hotels or during the year now. Cause we would just go to CVS or Walgreens at the end of the year to buy magazines. And there's like none anymore.
And so when you have the conversation at the end of the year, is it something very informal as well? Or is it really like each child?
We don't review it. They do it, but they do whatever they want. But we basically sit down on January 1st and do that together kind of on New Year's Day. So we cut out all the stuff and then it's always an argument for everyone to finish. I'm usually the first one to finish. And then I've gotten frustrated. I'm like, guy, the stuff's around the house a month later. We're like, look, we either get this done or I'm not harassing anyone. Like, you guys want to do it? Like, we finish them. But like, because it ends up being on the dining room table for a month. And then my wife's getting frustrated because it's a mess. So we've tried to like, just like do whatever you want to do that you can get done.
Very cool. Do you have any other particular traditions that feel particularly unique for your family?
That's one we try to get out for the first ski day of the year, you know, around Thanksgiving. My daughter and I, we started running like the turkey trot on Thanksgiving, and we're doing that again this year. At least three of us are doing it. So I think there are these things around holidays, like our big ski family. So the first run or the last run ritual, the New Year's things, you know, now a lot of these things are really around holidays, right? That's when all of us, there's a couple holidays a year when we all have the chance to be together. Again, I think the family dinners is super important. Like when we're home, we should try to do that. And then you can go out afterwards.
Very cool. I always ask this last question to all my guests, which is, you know, the messy side of fatherhood, of course, means we've got to include a messy story. And can you think back to maybe when your kids were a lot younger, and do you have like one in particular, you know, poop, pee, vomit, some sort of crazy story from raising three, no doubt, rambunctious kids and what that's brought you over the course of the last 20 some odd years?
I mean, there are a lot of those. I remember when we all had the stomach bug and no one would come into our house. And it was like, we could like, can we get help with three little kids? People were like, no. And we would like put the kids in the crib so that we could pass out. And we'd go in there and it just, you know, when they're young enough where they don't know when they're going to, there's nothing you can do with that. And they don't know when they're going to throw up. So you have to just like put them back in the crib and wait for them to throw up. God, that was like, that was just horrible. But, you know, in terms of the personality being the same and realizing, you know, that your kids hear what you say, my youngest is just always into stuff. Like he just was always getting into everything. Like we couldn't lose sight of him. And he had I still have this picture somewhere. He would like get my we bought him a little fake razor set, and then he would like take the real razors. That's a really bad idea. But he somehow took the can of shaving cream out of the bathroom when he was like two or three into his room. I walk into his room. I look at him. He is covered with the shaving cream all down his face, dripping, like with sunglasses on, and looks at me and just goes, "Oh, Zachary." he just knew what our response was going to be. And I would tell you, he is 17 years old now, and that still defines a lot of his personality.
It sounds like it would. Awesome. Well, Bob, I really appreciate all your insights and vulnerability. And this is going to be a great conversation for lots of dads to hear. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.